And now on the Talk of the Quad Cities, 1130 AM and 99.9 FM in Prescott and 95.5 FM in Prescott Valley and Cottonwood, KQNA. It's Talk of the Town. Today is the Thursday Roundtable Day. Talk of the Town is sponsored by A&E Reprographics, Augie's Restaurant, Barrett Propane, Cottonwood Area Transit, High Country Rec V Center, House Chilson and Associates, Olson's for Healthy Animals, Prescott Brewing Company, and the Yavapai Regional Medical Center. Now live from the studios of KQNA, here's your host for today's show, the owner of Arizona's hometown radio group, Sanford Cohen.
Welcome to an all-star edition of Talk of the Town here on KQNA. I'm Sanford Cohen. First up, my interview with the late Ronald Bell, better known as Cool from Cool and the Gang, Cherish, Celebration, Hollywood Swingin'. Then later, my interview with former heavyweight champ Tommy Morrison, who was later diagnosed with the AIDS virus and forced to retire from boxing. A very interesting story with a surprise ending. And then, after the news, the one and only Ted Nugent. Need I say more? Stay tuned. It's an all-star edition of Talk of the Town on KQNA AM 1130, 99.9 in Prescott, 95.5 Prescott Valley Cottonwood, streaming live worldwide at KQNA.com.
You are listening to Talk of the Town on KQNA. Once again, here's your host for today's show, Sanford Cohen.
Well, today we've got the pleasure of talking with a true legend in music. We're talking about Cool from Cool and the Gang, and he is joining us here on KQNA. And welcome, sir.
Yeah, how are you doing there?
We're doing wonderfully, and I got to say that I don't know how many of these interviews you do in a year's time or over the lifetime of your career with Cool and the Gang, but I got to take you back to a moment when I first encountered Cool and the Gang. And I hope it doesn't make you feel real old. I was in Detroit listening to my favorite station, Keener 13. That's when AM ruled the radio waves. And Cool and the Gang came out with a song called Cool and the Gang. And it was all instrumental. And I gotta say, first of all, that there aren't a lot of instrumental hits like that with a brand new group. What made you decide to debut with a song that was all instrumental, number one, and number two, to call it Cool and the Gang?
I would take you back a little ways there, Sanford. Actually, we're celebrating 50 years in the business. The group started back in 1964 as the Jazzy Acts, and then it was changed to the Soul Town Band. We're backing up a lot of local talent in Jersey City. They were trying to be like Motown. They called themselves Soul Town, and we were the band. And then we left that organization, and we changed our name to Cool and the Flame, because it was the MC who kept calling in. That's Cool on bass. So one night we came into a club, he had Cool and he had Flames and Fire, and it was an interesting concept. So we took that name on for about a month until we met our producer, Gene Red. At that time, Gene Red, our father was managing road manager for James Brown and the Famous Flame. So we said, no, we don't want that. We don't want to have any problems with the Godfather. So we changed the Flame to Gang, and we came up with Cool and the Gang. So our very first record, change of the name from Cool and the Flames to Cool and the Gang. It all came out in 1969, which is...
Well, and I must say it made a big splash. I mean, to me, it almost seemed like you were trying to catch the same kind of funk groove that, like, the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band was doing back then. But there was nothing like Cool and the Gang when you guys debuted.
Yeah, we were one of the first. I mean, you had guys like the Bar Caves, who were the backup band for Otis Redding, but there was not that many. You had the Meters, I believe, but there wasn't many instrumental bands like us.
Well, then you had a pretty interesting run of success with, I guess, what I would call the original funky lyrical version of Cool and the Gang. And these were the songs that were Jungle Boogie, Hollywood Swingin', and that was kind of, that must have been a real joy for you guys to have hit after hit after hit, because the time between Cool and the Gang, the instrumental, when that hit and these other songs came out one right after another, there was a little bit of time there, And I was kind of wondering, what is Kool and the Gang going to be about? And so when you followed up the instrumental with songs like Jungle Boogie and Hollywood Swingin' and all that, you became kind of like a good time band with very humorous lyrics.
Yeah, we had a few records. We released a few records on that time period, but they were more territorial records. After Kool and the Gang, we had, but the first big one was Funky Stuff. And after Funky Stuff came Hollywood Swingin' and then Jungle Boogie.
Because I got to tell you, even to this day, when the guy who was lead then, that was doing the and all that, I mean, where did that all come from?
His name was Donald Voice. We called him the Voice. And we were in the studio just kicking it, you know. let me try to make this a short story here. Right after that time, our record company, we hadn't had any big hits. You know, we had those territorial hits. And they wanted to put us with this producer who was producing Mongo the Mongo. And had that big record, Soul Makusa.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one meeting with the guy, and we said, we can't deal with this. It's not working. So we went into a studio called Baggy in New York, down in the Village. And we went in there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we just jammed and jammed. And by that evening, we had created Hollywood Swingin', Funky Stuff, and Jungle Boogie. All dance, fun records, you know?
Yeah.
After that, we didn't get no more problems from the record company after that.
I bet not. Those are big hits and really solidified Kool and the Gang as a hit-making machine. But now the sound evolved to something, I guess, for lack of a better word, something a little more polished, and the disco era started to kick in, and that's when you guys really hit the big time in terms of worldwide acceptance with songs like Cherish and Celebration and so on. Talk about what it was like within the band, because obviously, you know, your name is on it, so you've been kind of the de facto leader of this outfit. And were there any discussions within the band about losing some of that hard edge that you established with Jungle Boogie and Hollywood Swingin' and going to something that was a little more, you know, for lack of a better word, a little more polished, a little more symphonic?
What happened at that time, Stafford, was around the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, 70s. 1978, and we were out on tour with the Jacksons. We were opening up for the Jacksons, and this promoter guy, a gentleman by the name of Dick Griffey, he came to us. He said, "You guys got a good show. You know, you got, you know, your hits of the 70s, etc. So I think you guys need is missing as the lead singer." We said, "Oh, okay, we'll take a look at that." Because at that time, you had Maurice White and Philip Bailey with Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you had Lionel Richie with the Commodores. And that's when we decided, okay, let's go and see if we can get a lead singer. And that's when we met J.T. Taylor. And he was doing some recording over at our studio. A gentleman who was working with us by the name of Val Hackett. And so I got James Taylor, J.T. Taylor, you know, to be the lead singer. He said, okay, well, we like, and we went through various song changes and chord changes with JT, and he fit right in. We didn't have to audition a whole lot of people, and we went on to create the very first record called Ladies Night, and that became a huge hit for us.
Mm-hmm.
That same record, Too Hot, and then Get Down on It, and Cherish and Fresh, and on and on.
Now, when you look back on your 50 years in the music business, are you surprised? Are you grateful? Are you shocked at how long Kool and the Gang has been able to remain a viable touring performing band over half a century?
Well, that's a blessing because, you know, in this business, it's an up and down situation here. And we started in the 60s, you know, nobody really knowing us, going to the 70s with that funk edge sound that we had, you know. Then we were on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack with the Bee Gees and John Travolta. That was a big launch for us, late 70s. And then we survived the 80s. And then J.T. Taylor left at the end of the 80s. We continued to build our career around the world during that time. Then J.T. came back in 1995, and we did another record together, and he left in 1999. So we have, you know, we survived that, continuing to build our international market. Started doing tours and worked with various groups, various rock festivals over in Europe. And then 2 years ago, we nailed the big one with Van Halen.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up doing 48 shows with Van Halen 2 years ago, and that broadened our market. And then right after that, we get a call from Kid Rock. We did 10 shows with Kid Rock last year, and also a couple of shows with the Dave Matthews Band. And we're working on a new It's a Celebration 50 Years of Cooling Gang record for some of the young producers out there, and hope to do another major tour next year. Our career continuously building, you know, which is amazing. Being out there for over, you know, almost 50 years this year.
Well, I guess one of the badges of honor for a performing group nowadays is that you are not the subject of an episode of Unsung. That, in fact, Kool and the Gang is getting all the props that they deserve for the many years of hits and the great music that has been brought forward. And you just don't hear a lot of, you know, scandal and things like that associated with your group. And I'm wondering if that's part of the culture within your band, that you guys had very little tolerance for people that wanted to go out and act up.
Yeah, and then, you know, our parents, from the very beginning, you know, stood behind us and told us, you know, to stay together as a group and work together. And I just lost my mother about 3 weeks ago. And she was the last of the mothers that have that passed. And so I feel that she and all of us will be proud of us right now, of what we have accomplished and hopefully what we will continue to accomplish in the future.
Now, I know, too, that one of the signatures of the Kool and the Gang sound is the horn section. And I just wonder what caused you to want to rely so heavily on horns in making your sound, because I can tell you that part of the stage performance for Kool and the Gang is that your horn section is very tight. They choreograph a little bit, and you know, it's not like you're going to sit there and just watch a bunch of guys stand there and play. You guys are entertainers just as much as you are musicians.
Yeah, that started back in the 60s when we were the backup band for these groups out of Jersey City. And what we would do when we did our own set, we would play the instrumental version of these songs, like Since I Lost My Baby or one of the songs that one of the groups might be doing from the Motown era.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started to establish the sound that had the horn as well as, you know, bass drums, guitar, and keyboards. It became our sound, like the very first record. And we continued to keep that sound, you know, throughout the years. Even with JT, when JT joined the band, and our producer, Yamir Diodato, was saying, now, hey, guys, you got to make some room for a lead singer now. He can't be playing through all the tracks like he was in the 70s. So we had to create a sound around JT to some degree, but we always wanted to keep our identity with the horns. When you hear those horns, you say, oh, that's cool again. I don't know who the new guy's singing, but I know who's playing. I mean, we're working pretty much over 100 shows a year. And then every now and then a tour pops in there. We like to do something with the Doobie Brothers at some point. We work with the group Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Meatloaf. So if you're not doing a reality show or doing a Burger King commercial, you're in trouble.
I'm just thinking the Kool and the Gang reality show. That'd be funny. Hey, I gotta also ask you, Kool, that you know, being around as long as you have and having all the hits and so forth, when you get to be a certain age, isn't this like when you should start getting like the Lifetime Achievement Awards and stuff like that?
Well, I'm glad you said that, Sam. So people are listening, because we feel it's about time. We still haven't received anything like that in America, and we're still waiting for hopefully to be inducted into the fame. In Cleveland and some of the other things, hopefully a Legend Award or something for the Grammys or, you know, American Music Award. I mean, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So we're still waiting for America to come to the party.
Well, and I think America has partied to Kool and the Gang for 50 years, and you definitely, if you don't make an episode of the program Unsung that you hear, that you see on Eccentric, you are definitely unsung in terms of those accolades, which are certainly well-deserved. I mean, a band like yours that has been ambassadors for American music around the world for so many years and still bringing it each and every night, 100 dates plus a year. You know, if nothing else, I think your discography and the fact that you're still, one of the hardest working bands in show business right now, hopefully people will sit up and take notice and start sending some of those cards and letters into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because it's high time, I think, that Kool and the Gang deserves that level of recognition.
You're right.
Big Red Rib Festival down at Cardinal Stadium on April 26th. We're going to see the 2014 edition of Kool and the Gang.
We're just coming out to have a good time.
Now, well, it's hard for me to sit there and call them oldies because I remember when they were brand new. So they're current events as far as I'm concerned.
We hope to see everybody there.
All right. Well, again, Mr. Kool Bell from Kool and the Gang, 50 years of hits coming to the Big Red Rib Festival down in Glendale, and we're looking forward to it, and we really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us. It's been an awesome pleasure to talk with you, sir.
Well, thank you.
That's Ronald Bell, founder of Kool and the Gang, who passed away this past September. We'll be right back with former heavyweight champ Tommy Morrison, who fought against the AIDS virus, and it cost him his career, and later, the Motor City Madman Ted Nugent. You're listening to an all-star edition of Talk of the Town on KQNA AM 1130, 99.9 in Prescott, 95.5 Prescott Valley Cottonwood, streaming live worldwide at kqna.com. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Talk of the Town on KQNA. Once again, here's your host for today's show, Sanford Cohen.
And joining me now here, the former IBC and WBO heavyweight champion, Tommy Morrison, who's coming to the Cliff Castle Casino this weekend for the Rumble in the Red Rocks. Tommy, we welcome you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Boy, I'll tell you, you want to talk about a story. You have had five lifetimes in your 38 years that you've been running around this earth, and I'm very curious, before we talk about that, when you get to the height that you have been, where you're a world heavyweight champion and a celebrity and all that, what's it like to be in a big fishbowl like that?
Well, a lot of people react to it differently. You know, a lot of people have world-class talent, but something about fighting in front of a crowd, they get what they call stage fright. You know, Oliver McCall would be a good example of that. Great fighter in the gym, what you call a gym fighter, but in front of a live crowd, he freezes up and he gets nervous. So it's not something that, is easy to do, but it's like anything else. The more you do it, the more you get used to it, and it just depends on the type of personality you have as a fighter, really.
Well, I'll tell you, you have certainly had your share of big-time bouts about guys like James Quick Tillis. We're talking about Ray Mercer, Art Tucker, Carl the Truth Williams, and of course, one of the more legendary fights, and that is the fight for the WBO title against the comebacking heavyweight legend George Foreman. That turned out in your favor. Talk a little bit about what the mood was leading up to that fight and what it was like for you to defeat George Foreman.
You know, it was kind of a double-edged sword to a certain degree. And what I mean by that is that he was old enough and his skills were, not quite as polished as they were. It's all business, We did promotional tours leading up to this fight. I went away and did, 9 weeks of training at BMI, which is Virginia Military, at an all-male academy. It's just all no women, all that sort of thing. And we had, 8 weeks of very disciplined training and, it was no secret going out there and beating Foreman. I went back and watched the two fights that he had lost up to that point, and that was against Muhammad Ali and Jimmy Young. Now, we watched those fights over and over and over again. My trainer said, now, why did these guys beat him? I said, because they didn't stand in front of him. Foreman likes to fight people that aren't very that are pretty stationary. They don't move around a lot. And sooner or later, over a 12-round period, he's going to be able to land that big right hand. With me, the key to beating him is just don't stand in front of him. You go in, you throw four or five punch combinations, and you move. And for someone with such an extraordinary amount of ring experience, two-time world champion, never learned how to cut off the ring. Or, in order to cut off the ring, he may have known how to do it, but in order to do that effectively, you've got to be in great shape. And, I don't think Foreman ever really trained that hard. He was just a lot more relaxed in his second career than he was the first one. His first career, he had kind of the same problem that I did. I didn't know how to relax. So I go out there and I'm trying to take your head off of the jab even, you know, and that tires you out. And that plagued me a little bit in my first career. But now that I'm older, more seasoned, I think differently. My approach to the sport is different. I understand it better. And everything is just coming together. I really believe that I'll be a much better fighter this time than I was the first time.
Well, that's terrific. And, of course, we'll talk about the Rumble in the Red Rocks coming up this Saturday here in just a moment. You burst on the scene, though, in a rather unusual way back in 1989. Sylvester Stallone was a spectator at one of your fights and realized that you would be ideal for Rocky V. Now, how did that come about?
Well, that was actually it was his brother. His brother Frank Stallone is the one that saw me, and he knew that Stallone, that Sly was looking for, you know, someone to play this character. And oddly enough, they had already selected someone that they wanted to play, and it was a kid named Derek Eiselman, who was an amateur fighter that I lost to in the National Gold Gloves out of high school. They'd already selected him to play the part. And I was the last, they auditioned like 650 people for this part, and I was the last guy that they auditioned. And went in there and, you know, we did a screen test, and, you know, Stallone called me back a couple weeks later, and, you know, I still got all my, you know, my answer machine. You know, I saved the tape, you know, where he called me and said, you know, they auditioned like over 650 people for this part, and they decided that they want to use me. And it was a blessing, you know, during this process, I found out that I really had a passion for it.
Really? So you thought maybe Hollywood would become more of a permanent part of your life?
That's certainly something that I entertain. You know, I mean, that's something that I want to do. I had a passion for it. When I have a passion for something, when I'm motivated and have a desire to do something, it's just my nature. I'll become better at it than anyone else. It's just not that many things motivate me. You know, acting did. Boxing did. You know, I mean, it's anytime you can go out and declare physical dominance over someone, it's a good feeling. It's like the base player Bonds gets a very swings a bat, hits the ball. He doesn't even look. He knows it's going out. You know, it's called sweet thunder is what they call it. And it's the same thing in boxing. You know, you step up there and, you know, take somebody out. It's a good feeling. I don't particularly like beating people up for a living, but it's a sport, you know, and that's the way I look at it.
Well, there was talk after you had defeated George Foreman of going up against Lennox Lewis, and there was a number of other fights that took place, and then, of course, the IBC Heavyweight Championship against Razor Ruddock. And then you suffered probably one of the biggest knockout punches that a person could encounter in life. And I'm talking about the HIV positive test that came out after one of your fights. And it basically brought your career to a crashing halt. How on earth did you possibly deal with that?
I think boxing, my life in boxing, I've been doing it for 32 years, you know, probably had a lot to do with it. I mean, when you get your head, you know, you get knocked down, you got to get up and dust off your trousers and come back and make something happen. You know, you got to overcome adversity. And that's all I've ever did my whole life. I've always been an overachiever, and I never believed I had it right from the get-go. I didn't live that kind of lifestyle. I mean, I was the least likely person to get something like that. I've never passed it to anyone. You know, I mean, so it's, you know, I believe what I believe. You know, I did the research, you know. People aren't inspired to get to know about something until it's shoved down your throat. You know, all of a sudden, okay, I'm told I'm having this, and everybody, you know, in a matter of 30 seconds, I stand up, I retire, I walk down, my foot hits the floor, and most of my life's different. I mean, people I grew up with for 22 years, you know, the town I grew up, went to high school, grew up, you know, friends of mine wouldn't even wave at me going to town. I mean, it's like all of a sudden the whole town wanted me out of there. You know, I went on a ski trip, my house burned down. They didn't want me there. You know, so I moved. I moved to Arkansas, which is just right across the Oklahoma lines. I want to stay close to my mother and family, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, this whole thing, of course, came to a head late last year. The head of the Arizona State Boxing Commission personally watched you take a blood test at a lab in Phoenix and receive the official results demonstrating once and for all that you are HIV negative. How did you feel when that test result came forward? Because you really doubted that positive test all along.
I always did. You know, and the people are like, well, did you get an additional test later on? I'm like, yeah, I did, but the things that I was taking at the time, which was over-counter supplements, steroids, you know, things like that will cause you to have a false positive. There's so much information out there that people don't know about. You know, your average guy sitting on the couch at home, as I mentioned a while ago, you know, no one's inspired to get to know about something, to research it, so it's shoved down your throat. You know, and once it does that, they have, I wanted to get to know, you know, what they told me I had. And the more I researched it, the more I studied it, the more I found out everything they were telling me was a lie. You know, the world here in a couple of weeks will you know, we'll find out that that's in fact true. You know, Shannon Briggs just relinquished the last American title this Saturday night. He got beat by another Russian. So now every heavyweight championship is held by a Russian. Now, that's the first time in history that's ever happened. First time in the history of boxing that we haven't had an American heavyweight champion. So society, particularly the boxing public, are ready for it. You know, it's been 10 or 12 years. Boxing goes to a low point about every 10 or 12 years. It's like it did back in 85 when Tyson came along. You know, the heavyweight, I mean, Larry Holmes had been champion for 8 years. You know, they give you an indication of how weak the division was. Tyson came along. He wasn't Superman, but he was, you know, he was short, you know, quick, hit hard, and threw punches in combination. That's all you have to do to elevate yourself in this division. You know, heavyweights these days are lazy. I'll give you an example. Look at James Toney. I mean, this guy was a light heavyweight, you know, super middleweight. 2 years back. Now he's 240 pounds. You know, that's a prime example of what happens when you take steroids and don't lift weights. You get fat. Klitschko brothers, you know, either one of them bees would beat. Just go out and, I mean, you go out there and be apprehensive and try, you know, you go out there and you go right after him, you hit him on the chin. That's all you do.
I was just going to say, boxing really desperately needs to get back to its glory days. It really has kind of fallen off the radar screen, hasn't it?
I'd agree with you more, and hopefully we'll be, you know, I hope to be the start of that anyway. Trying to keep things up a little bit, get people excited again. You know, that's what needs to happen.
So now you're going to make your MMA debut when you step into the cage to face 340-pound mixed martial artist John Stover. The bout scheduled on Saturday at Cliff Castle Casino, presented by Worldwide Fighting Championship. It's the Rumble in the Red Rocks. What's your expectation for this Saturday?
I'm not going to mess around. I mean, this is what they call a stand-up striking match. You know, the president of the UFC is a guy named Dana White, who's been blowing off saying that, you know, Chuck would or stand up a striker would beat a fighter. You know, fighters, they know that that's crazy talk. I mean, we're skilled and we're trained to hit a moving target. Those guys don't move their head. They're not used to getting hit. And which proved Saturday night, Chuck Liddell got hit on the chin with a little right hand. Looked like some guy was trying to sling poo-poo off his fingers. I hit him on the chin and knocked him out. You know, I mean, these guys just don't understand what they're dealing with. And, you know, I'm going over there to make a point. You know, I'm going to put an exclamation point at that and let these guys know they don't have any business in there with someone like me or someone like Mercer or Butterbean. Butterbean, you know, he's been putting people in the hospital, you know, in these things. And he's like, in boxing, he's like below mediocre, you know. So they just don't have any idea what they're dealing with. But, you know, we're going to, slowly but surely, we're gonna make sure that they see our point.
Well, champ, we certainly say welcome back. It's good to have you back, and we're looking forward to some good times on Saturday night, and hopefully we'll catch you down there.
Appreciate it. You have a good time. Thanks for having me on. You guys be good. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, Tommy.
And sadly, Tommy Morrison passed away not from AIDS, but from a host of other health issues at just 44 years of age. The news is up next, and then my interview with Ted Nugent coming up on KQ&A AM 1130, 99.9 in Prescott, 95.5 Prescott Valley Cottonwood, streaming live worldwide at KQ&A.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Talk of the Town on KQ&A. Once again, here's your host for today's show, Sanford Cohen.
And now, on the day of his Prescott Valley concert appearance, here's my talk with Ted Nugent.
All right, well, tonight is a very important night here in Prescott Valley, as folks have been anticipating for months now. The one and only Motor City Madman, Ted Nugent, is going to be live on stage tonight at the Tim's Toyota Center, and Ted joins us here as he's getting ready for tonight's performance. And I've got to say, first of all, Ted, that someone of your advanced chronological status, how do you go about keeping that high energy up on stage? What do you do to stay in shape?
Sanford, I can conclude that statement with one word. Venison, pure protein on the hoof. No, I've been a hunter my whole life, and I was raised in a really loving, disciplined family, so I've been clean and sober for 66 throttling rhythm and blues, rock and roll, freedom-drenched years. And when you take good care of your sacred temple and you remain clean and sober and you eat the purity of renewable venison every hunting season, this is how you conduct yourself, with much fire.
Well, I know that here in the Prescott area, hunting is very important, and you've probably maybe had a chance to spend a little time in the outback here in Arizona during your time.
You know, Sanford, I do have a lot of hunting friends all over the country. I've been touring nonstop since the late 50s, quite honestly. I used to play some sock hops and some malt shops in Detroit. But, no, I got a lot of hunting friends. I've probably hunted every state. The hunting season is a sacred time in the Nugent House, much like it is for my Arizona friends. And when I'm on tour, I think we can both agree, Sanford, that the greatest philosopher of all times was Dirty Harry when he said a good man knows his limitations. So if I'm going to rock my skeleton into talcum powder every night on stage like I do with my incredible band and the incredible high-energy songs, I think I need lots of rest. Plus, I just had both of my knees replaced this year, and I've been kind of going through some pain management the last 4 months, and they're getting better every day, so I will be dancing like an animal tonight, and then I don't just sleep. I become suspended animation comatose every night because I put everything I got into every song, every concert.
Well, let's go back to 1967 and your time in Detroit. I was born in Detroit, and I was one of those young teenagers who thought that Ted Nugent was Jimi Hendrix before there was a Jimi Hendrix. You had that song, Journey to the Center of the Mind with the Amboy Dukes. How did your first band get together, and what was it like to have a national hit right out of the box like that?
Well, I got to tell you, being a Detroiter yourself, you remember that Detroit really was the greatest city in the world. When I was born there in 1948, right up into the 60s until the Liberal Democrats dismantled the American dream, which we can talk about in a minute. But that musical authority, that ferocious, uppity, intense rhythm and blues that was Motown also manifested itself with Bob Seger and Grand Funk Railroad and the MC5, and nowadays, of course, with Kid Rock and Eminem and Jack White. But the Amboy Dukes were already turned on by those black heroes, the Howlin' Wolf, and certainly Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry and James Brown and Wilson Pickett. So we practiced and practiced and practiced and put our heart and souls into every lick, every song. So when that song came out, it was our second album in 1968, we were just on a runaway freight train of just creating music and touring. We played 300-plus concerts a year. We lived and breathed and just loved the music, and we were doing our damnedest to try to represent that Motown groove and that excitability that was such an uppity Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels-inspired concert every night. So, it registered, and we certainly took advantage of the admiration of the music that we were creating. But I got to tell you, the guys that fell for the scam of celebrity and fell into the scam of peer pressure with the drugs and the alcohol, unfortunately, they did not survive those years. And because I was clean and sober and maintained my focus on the music, the music, the music, the music, the music, here it is 50 years later, quite honestly, and I'm going to do my 6,500th concert this year. And it's because I've been clean and sober. It's because I've been prioritized with the aim small, miss small discipline of the outdoor lifestyle, the marksmanship, the mystical flight of the arrow, the hunting, the fishing, the trapping. That cleanses my soul. It fortifies my spirit, and it allows me to play this unbelievable music every night. So the music and the success is exciting and fun, but I've got a brand new record out right now called Shut Up and Jam, and I think the title says it all. Yeah, the celebrity is cute, doesn't mean anything to the deer, doesn't help deer walk in front of me, and with my incredible wife and my sons and daughters and grandkids and brothers and sisters, my band, my crew, everybody around me is so positive, so dedicated, so professional, that the music is for the music. You don't gauge it on successful record sales. You don't gauge it on the admiration. You gauge it on the authenticity and the authority of the music, and that's what my guys and I do every night.
So if nobody liked it, you really don't care. You're playing for yourself.
You know, it sounds selfish, but if I satisfy this Herculean music lover inside of the Ted Nugent body, then I guarantee the ticket buyer will always get more than their money's worth. And let me just say that with Mick Brown on drums, from Arizona, by the way, and Greg Smith on bass guitar, Derek St. Holmes, not to mention my incredible crew, every concert, Sanford, is the most important concert of our life. Every song, every night is the most important musical moment in our life. We still love the music because by the time I'm done hunting for 6 to 8 months every year, I can't wait to get back on the road and play these unbelievable songs. So I'm still like the kid in the garage with his first loud amplifier every night. So that's why I think the longevity of my career is attributable to the love of the music, not just by the fans, but because me and my guys, we're the biggest fans of all.
Well, you know, Ted, as much as I admire what you've done musically, I am absolutely in awe of what you've done politically in terms of taking a very public stance against what you see as something that runs counter to the American ideal. Talk a little bit about growing up and how your political philosophy got started and evolved and where you think it's important for people like you to speak out today.
Well, number one, thank you for that. I get that everywhere I go, thanking me for actually performing my responsibilities as we the people to stand up, to demand accountability, to demand that the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, is the guiding force in our elected employees' policy-making lives, and that's obviously gone haywire. I'll try to keep it in a reasonable radio-length response for you, but I was born in the glow of the American good as victory celebration over the evil of the Japanese Empire and the Nazis. We were united that good America, this experiment in self-government, where the king didn't have control over us, where the king got to have arms, but we the people were not allowed to have arms. We wrote it down in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, so we celebrate those self-evident truths, those God-given individual rights that our founding fathers wrote down so that kings and tyrants and emperors, Obama notwithstanding, would not be able to tread upon these sacred pillars of a free man. So as I was growing up, I was a victim of the so-called American education system. So by the time I graduated high school in 67, I was clueless about how the world worked. I didn't know what communism was. I never heard of the Bataan Death March, and I wasn't told anything about World War II. But I learned about it through just investigation and reading. I was a voracious reader of publications and books and scientific manuals and whatnot. And as a hunter and a fisherman and trapper, I saw the pollution and how we the people could turn Lake Erie from spontaneously ignited from the pollution to where the hunters and the fishermen and the trappers sounded the alarm, where we the people cleaned it up, where it's now the cleanest walleye and smallmouth bass fishery in the world. My point being is that my political activism is on all intellectual, all historical, and I believe spiritual levels, the absolute job one of every American, where we the people are supposed to demand accountability from our elected employees, and as it manifested itself to this tragedy under the Chicago scam artist Barack Obama, who's never earned a dime in his life. He's been supported by scams and by government grants and by this great society, which is a not so great society, and this New Deal, which was a raw deal. And a lot of people in the Prescott Valley right now probably don't even know what I'm talking about. But that's why we've got the scam artist in chief. That's why we've got a government who refuses to be accountable and allows to sick the IRS on political adversaries, and the NSA gets to listen to our phone and look in our windows without authority, and where the government of Sanford, the official statement by the government of the United States is that the Fort Hood terrorist attack was a workplace violence episode? Are you kidding me? So these kinds of violations, these kinds of corrupt, abusive power, criminal acts by our gun-running attorney general and his president, and by Hillary Clinton, who refuses to provide security in the most demanding security situations for American citizens ever, it angers we the people, and I am a we the people, so for my kids and my grandkids and for my own duty to speak up, I raise as much hell as I can, I spotlight as many cockroaches as I can, and I try to get them fired and hopefully tried, convicted, and jailed, because I believe that a preponderance of our elected officials in the United States of America today are criminally guilty of violating their oath to the Constitution, and I believe they should be arrested, I believe they should be tried, I believe they should be convicted, and I'd like to see the President, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and I'd like to see Eric Holder, and I'd like to see Nancy Pelosi and a bunch of the others, I'd like to see them put in jail where they belong.
So let me ask you, I know that there are people whom you socialize with that share your views and are very supportive of you, but in the circles that you run, you do tend to spend more time with people in the performing arts that perhaps have a different point of view. Have you had the opportunity to express this kind of sentiment to those people, and have there been any of them that have taken what you've said and actually changed their point of view as a result of the passion in your comments?
My passion is a result of evidence, research, statistics, and facts. Not Ted Nugent facts, not convenient facts, documented, corroborated facts. Historical evidence and current evidence. I mean, everybody knows that Barack Obama and Eric Holder authorized and facilitated the illegal running of guns to Mexican drug gangs. This isn't a Ted Nugent hunch. This has been documented. We have footage. We have tape recordings. We know what they're guilty of. We know that our embassy in Benghazi begged for security in a dangerous area, and that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton et al. Denied them security. Sanford, I went to the feed mill this morning. I'm a guitar player. I had better security on my belt going to the feed mill than our embassy did in Benghazi after numerous threats. This is like the Twilight Zone meets the cuckoo's nest. So yes, I do express this, and I have changed minds because I've pounded back the facts. But the left is scared to death of me, because if you Google Ted Nugent and Piers Morgan, my facts trump guesswork and fantasy. My facts and my evidence and my statistics destroy the presumptuousness and the denial that is the battle cry of the left. The left is all about feeling good instead of doing good. If Barack Obama was in charge of Old Yeller, he would have brought him to school for the children to pet as he wiped the foam off his mouth. In my world, you shoot Old Yeller between the eyes because he's got rabies. It's a reality. So I still have, shall we say, I'm being kind and generous when I use the word debate, because they always give me, yeah, but still, if you didn't shoot the deer, they would live forever. You know, and if you're on enough drugs or acid or methamphetamine, I suppose you can pretend that. But I trounce them every time, which is why they're mostly afraid of me. And I appreciate the opportunity to let the world know that whenever somebody from the left tries to debate me, they end up looking like Piers Morgan.
Now, you hit on a point, though, that I want to make sure that people understand, because this is something that I've learned in my years as an off-highway vehicle advocate, and that is that if it wasn't for the hunters, the environment would suffer, because if you leave the deer population out there on its own, it will overcome and overwhelm the environment. That's why I think the hunters actually play a role in the overall conservation of the environment.
Wow, you must have learned that information in spite of our education. Well, and Sanford, what you're saying is a self-evident truth. It has been proven time and time again with the animal rights freaks as they come out of their little LSD-inspired lie. Where they've banned deer hunting, every area where they've banned or compromised legitimate sustained yield of habitat carrying capacity, wildlife management, which is the most successful wildlife management model in the history of the world, where America has more deer, more cougars, more bear, more turkey, more geese and other game than ever in recorded history. Who doesn't celebrate that? And that is 100% the success and the model paid for and demanded by the hunters, the fishermen, and the trappers of this country. In those instances where the animal rights freaks have succeeded, those deer have turned their habitat into a moonscape. They die off and suffer tragically prolonged, dire suffering, and then our tax dollars are wasted to hire so-called sharpshooters, who happened to be the sheriff and his drinking buddy, and I'm not knocking my sheriff buddies, but that's what the so-called sharpshooters end up being, and then they go in and fix the dam with dangerous, irresponsible, tragic damage control, because the truth about wildlife management, sustained yield harvest, Thanksgiving management policy, that was quality control. So we fight, and we've been very successful at stopping the animal rights freaks. But a perfect example is in Colorado, where it's against the law to use hounds or bait for bear, and they never harvest an adequate number of bears, so we've got to compensate the alpaca ranchers and the cattle ranchers and the sheep ranchers from all the devastation from an overpopulation of black bears. And then the USDA hunter goes in, and he uses bait and hounds for damage control after millions upon millions of dollars are wasted because we, the people, weren't allowed to use the proven methodology to manage the bear population in a responsible management fashion. I mean, it literally is like Planet of the Apes meets the Cuckoo's Nest. So we fight, and yes, the hunters, fishermen, and trappers ultimately optimize quality air, soil, and water, which is optimized quality of life, because wildlife habitat, which we finance and regulate, is where our quality of air, soil, and water comes from. Hello!
Well, now, tonight's performance at Tim's Toyota Center, this is the opening week of the Shut Up and Jam Tour, and a brand new, I can't even call it a record anymore.
Yeah, it's a record. It's a CD or a little disc or something, but it's still a record where I come from.
Something you can pre-order right now, by the way, at Amazon.com, Shut Up and Jam. How did you get together with Sammy Hagar for this?
Well, Sammy and I are good buddies. You know, we probably don't agree on all politics, but he believes in self-defense. He believes in wildlife management. He believes that venison is the purest protein known to man. So we get along on all those pragmatic levels. Plus, we're all children of Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry, and he's just an unbelievably gifted, kind gentleman, just a good man to be around. And we've always jammed together, and we've always talked that we have to make music together. But not only is Sammy Hagar singing this incredible song, She's Gone, but also the great Johnny B. Bonanjic from Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, one of the most revered and respected drummers ever in the world, is also performing on this record. And I've got Mick Brown and Greg Smith and Derek St. Holmes and John Kutz. And the Shut Up and Jam record is just, it's just great, fun, rhythm and blues, rock and roll songs, some of the greatest songs I've ever written. People are just having a great time with it. But I think I would mention this in Prescott Valley, Sanford, that if you really, really want to make the left, and if you want to make animal rights speech really angry, buy many copies of my record and make it a success, and it will bring much anguish into their lives.
Good advice. Good advice from Ted Nugent, the Motor City Madman, who will be on stage tonight at the Tim's Toyota Center right here in Prescott Valley. And, Ted, I got to say that this is right up there with my interview with Ernie Harwell as two of my Detroit homeboys that I was able to actually have a conversation with. And I support what you're doing and really appreciate you spending the time with us, and look forward to having you on stage here in Prescott Valley tonight at Tim's Toyota Center.
Well, Santa, thank you very much. I appreciate those kind words and the opportunity to get the self-evident truth from the Nugent family across the airways. But God bless Arizona. God bless Prescott Valley. And thanks, everybody, for making Ted Nugent's Spirit of the Wild the number one hunting show ever on Outdoor Channel. And all these years of support, the band and the crew and my family, we thank you all for that. And remember that freedom is not free. So make sure you thank and you donate whatever you can to the military charities out there, to the most deserving people in the world.
Very well said, Ted. Thanks.
Thanks, Sanford. Godspeed.
The one and only Ted Nugent. Back with a final thought after this on Talk of the Town, KQ&A, AM 1130, 99.9 in Prescott, 95.5 Prescott Valley Cottonwood, streaming live worldwide at KQ&A.com. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Talk of the Town on KQ&A. Once again, here's your host for today's show, Sanford Cohen.
You can hear these interviews and more on my podcast page. Go to kqna.com and check out my celebrity series. We're adding new content all the time. Please be safe out there. Mark Levin is up next on the Talk of the Quad Cities KQ&A. No Let's Talk Sports tomorrow, but we want to wish all of you a safe and happy New Year's Eve. We will see you next year, and have a great holiday weekend, everybody.
You've been listening to Talk of the Town on KQ&A. Today's show was sponsored by A&E Reprographics, Augie's Restaurant, Barrett Propane, Cottonwood Area Transit, High Country Rec V Center, House Chilson and Associate, Olson's for Healthy Animals, Prescott Brewing Company, the Prescott Chamber of Commerce, and Yavapai Regional Medical Center. The views expressed on today's show do not necessarily reflect the views of KQNA, Prescott Valley Broadcasting, our employees, or our advertisers. Join us next time for Talk of the Town on the Talk of the Quad Cities, 1130 AM, 99.9 FM in Prescott, and at 95.5 FM in Prescott Valley and Cottonwood, KQNA.